Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. I'm today joined by Michael Maiden, who is director of the China Energy Programme at the Institute, to discuss her two papers, Glimpses of China Energy Future and China Energy Security at 70, that were published by the OIS in September and October 2019. Michael, great to have you here in Oxford.
Thank you
so much for coming up. Look, let's just start with kind of general question if we can. You know, China is the largest oil and gas major. China's National Petroleum Corporation, CNPC, it released its 2050 outlook in late August 2019. Can you perhaps summarise for our listeners the key messages from this outlook?
Sure. So I think a bit of background as well. I mean, CNPC, as you said, is the biggest oil and gas company in China.
Yep.
But it is also an advisor to the government. We have to remember these are state-owned companies, mm-hmm. and the reports and the research that they write are also mandated by the government.
Right.
So
right.
It's a cyclical kind of process where they're being not exactly told what to write, but the general direction of travel based on which they produce their forecasts, which then inform the government.
So when we see the forecast, therefore, we can be pretty sure that they are state-supported, can we?
They are state-supported, and again, they will inform state thinking as mm-hmm. they head into the next policy cycle. We're right about to start the 14th five-year plan,
yeah.
and so there's a lot of planning and thinking going into that
yeah.
in 2020. So we have to bear in mind this is the fossil fuel industry that's working on a certain textbook, which
right.
it believes to be the government's, what the government would like to hear,
yeah.
and producing this analysis. And to be fair, in the past, they've gotten their forecasts wrong. I mean, we don't know the 2050 forecast yet, obviously, but the 2017, 2018 year ahead outlooks right. they've done have been wrong in the past. But the reason we chose to write about this is that it is informative to see the way the fossil fuels industry is thinking about China's energy futures.
Yeah.
And again, this will inform some of the debates and the thinking going into the 14th five-year plan.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I think in the context of, you know, a world that's thinking about decarbonisation
yeah.
and the
yeah.
end of coal or how to get rid of coal, the outlook from China is different. It's very
yeah.
different in the sense that they see peak energy demand somewhere in 2040, because again,
right.
this is a country that's still growing,
mm-hmm,
and they
mm-hmm.
still have people, perhaps not to lift out of poverty,
yeah.
but that want cars and that want to travel, and
mm-hmm.
so therefore, demand is still rising, and
yeah.
they don't see demand peaking before sort of 2035 or 2040.
Michael, I was surprised. I was surprised when I read that in your paper, you know, because you know, the baseline scenario is one of ongoing energy demand growth, as you say, up to 2040. And even with the most environmentally progressive scenario, pegging 2050 demand at 2035, I think it's difficult, perhaps for my European mindset, to actually imagine energy demand growing for hydrocarbons through to 2035.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
And it's energy demand in total,
yeah,
right?
Okay,
for
yes,
all
yes,
of them.
Yeah.
And so coal demand has basically peaked and
yeah.
is now starting to level off.
Yeah.
But yes, this is an economy that's growing, right? It's an emerging market. We tend to view it often as a developed market on some levels
mm-hmm.
because China's so predominant and the traders and manufacturers. But if you think of sort of energy consumption on a per capita level,
yeah.
is tiny in China still.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the country consumes, sort of it's the second import, so it's the first global importer of oil, it's what, the fifth importer of natural gas globally,
mm-hmm.
but on a per capita level, consumption is still very low, and so
mm-hmm.
the ambition is to keep growing and to keep producing
mm-hmm.
the fuel that is necessary for people to move into new urban
mm-hmm.
living and
mm-hmm.
to have that heated and to have
mm-hmm.
all the modern electrical appliances and to own cars. I mean, at least
yep.
one car.
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking about 180 cars per 1,000 people in China today versus European country that's 500
yep.
cars per 1,000 people. So,
mm.
you know, and from the Chinese leadership's perspective, we also need to bear in mind that when they think about environment,
mm.
they think about air quality
yes.
and having blue skies,
yeah.
Not so much about global greenhouse gas emissions.
So it's a particulate discussion they're having rather than, as you said, CO2.
Exactly,
yeah.
it's a particulate discussion, and so the measures needed to address that are
mm.
very different, because you can address some of those challenges with, well, what you call maybe a bit paradoxically clean coal, but sort of ultra-efficient coal-fired power plants emit less SOx and NOx, less particulate matters, than maybe some gas-fired power plants. Now, they're not good for the environment, they're not good for greenhouse gas emissions.
But they're better than the alternative.
Yes.
Which is the debate we have, of course, in the gas industry all around the world. Mm. Let's just come back to something you've mentioned, which is the starting off on the discussion on the environment. You know, I understand that China, in order to reduce its CO2 emissions, which is, of course, in support of the Paris Agreement, needs energy demand in 2050 to fall below 2017 levels. And I'm just wondering how they manage that conflicting message with the discussion we've just had on demand growth up to 2035. How do you balance those two?
So, of course, the Paris Agreement means that we need global, we need to reach a scenario that we are below 2 degrees Celsius, or 1.5 degrees Celsius globally. The Chinese pledges are to peak emissions by 2030,
right?
But they have not given absolute levels of emissions. So they have not committed to a level at which they peak emissions, and they have left their commitments, well, relatively vague.
So there's no benchmark they're working on.
There's no benchmark.
Okay.
So they're trying to reduce emissions, and that's also reflected in this report that they're already saying, I mean, the additions of renewables in the Chinese power sector every year are massive, and they by far outstrip. I mean, China accounts for 50% of total installed solar capacity every year. I mean, last year it added the equivalent of Germany in solar panels. So they're doing a lot in that respect, but coal is not going away.
Okay. Well, why don't we specifically talk about natural gas demand for a few minutes? You know, what is your view on gas demand growth in China? Because, you know, in your paper, I found it interesting, you identified that there's limited upside for natural gas. Why is that?
Well, so first of all, we have to, of course, put this in context. We've had 2 years of natural gas demand growth in China at 16-17% year on year. That's been sort of 37, almost 40 BCM increments every year.
Yeah.
Right? That's the size of what? Brazil every year.
And I have to say the global energy business has loved it because he's been the supporter of a lot of expansion projects, of course.
Exactly. So if the industry is factoring in those levels of growth, then they're in for, I think, a nasty surprise. Now, what is perhaps more realistic for China is 8-10% growth year on year in the next coming years, and then it slows down. Even the CNPC report talks about natural gas demand in China reaching 610 BCM in sort of 2030. We're at 280 now. So it's a gas market that's doubling in the scope of sort of 10, 15 years. It's still a massive increase.
One will ask, actually, if that's achievable.
And that, those levels are probably roughly achievable.
Right.
I mean, again, if you were to factor in a 12, 15% year-on-year growth from here on out, you would be reaching 700, 800, even more, 900 BCM.
So there is a drop-off in the percentage growth.
So there is a drop-off in the percentage growth, but we're still going to see a gas market that will double. Mm. Now, the thing that's important to bear in mind is that gas in China is not a power story.
Okay.
I think, again, when gas markets look at it, they say, well, China is electrifying, it's all going to be about gas, hence we've got massive demand.
Mm-hmm.
No, the growth that we've seen has come from industrial and commercial users that have been connected. The government has said, you move away from coal, you switch to gas.
Yep.
But there's a limit to that.
Yeah.
So they've moved 4 million households almost per year, households and commercial users, every year in northern China. But once that shift is done, you don't do it again. Southern China, the air quality issues aren't as bad.
Mm.
Central and Western China, you've got more price constraints.
Yeah.
So once you've done that, you've got a much bigger base, but you don't have those big increments again.
Mm.
And gas and power, I mean, you've got almost 90 gigawatts of installed capacity of gas.
Yeah.
The total power system is 1,900 gigawatts.
Yes, it's still quite a small percent. It was interesting, Michal, because you said something, and you said that the government has actually instructed this switch to gas. And that brings me to one of my questions, which I think you've answered, but I'd just like more clarification on. And that is, what are the main demand drivers? Is it politics, as you've just referred to, or is it economic growth or environmental factors, or all of them?
So it's a combination of all of them, I guess. It is cleaning up the skies, and so environmental factors. The coal to gas switch has been again about getting rid of small coal-fired boilers and replacing them with kind of centralized gas heatings or gas boilers. And politics have enabled that.
Yes.
Because the government has said you must make that switch, and it's also given subsidies. But local officials know that if they don't phase out coal, they won't be promoted.
So when we say politics in respect to China, are we talking about maybe policy or regulation?
Yes.
If we were setting the framework in a European context?
Yes, you would talk about policies and regulations.
Yes, yeah.
And just the fact that China has been capable of enforcing its policies and regulations with subsidies. I mean, you've had policies every so often encouraging gas and transport, but those are very small. So the next big question will be whether there will be a policy push for gas in power.
Right.
Not so much to phase out coal, but as sort of a peak shaving mechanism. But the downside potentially there is that the cost of renewables is falling, and so you'll get a bigger uptick in renewables while we still have coal in the power sector and nuclear. And so gas will be a bridge fuel. But it won't be a massive...
So in fact, you know, we talk about this a lot in the gas business, is the possibility of consumers moving straight to renewables from a coal or an oil base and almost missing out the gas stage. Do you think there's a possibility that could be the case in China?
Very possible.
Yeah.
And again, because it's such a big market, we're still going to go from 300 BCM to 550, right?
Yeah.
This is the scale of China.
Which is still small.
It is small in global terms.
Yeah.
But when you look at sort of the big industrial, sort of the other areas of residential consumption, transport, they're still relatively small.
Actually, you mentioned residential. That links back to something you said earlier on about the move from into the cities, from the outside of the cities, you know. And it all comes down to the changing demand, the changing face of demand in China. You know, is it moving towards a consumer-based demand? Is it going to be the consumer that's going to drive the demand, or is it going to be, as you briefly mentioned earlier on, power?
I mean, that's the general trend in China is to move away from sort of an industrial consumption model, right? All those heavy investments and heavy industry, and gradually have consumers be the driving force of the economy. And that's where you will see, but that's generally in the fuel mix, right? But China's biggest challenge, when we talk about decarbonisation and the way we see it as electrification, China could electrify faster than it can decarbonise.
Yes, okay. Yes, you've got the message. Well, why don't we talk about price for a minute? Because I think it was an interesting observation in your paper that said, you know, that the government, the Chinese government's plans for price reforms and broader liberalisation actually adds an element of uncertainty that could slow down gas demand growth. So how negative could this be to the gas demand growth numbers that we've been talking about?
I mean, it could be hugely detrimental. The fundamental question is, what would price reform look like?
Mm-hmm.
Currently, gas prices in China are indexed to LPG and fuel oil.
Mm-hmm.
What would they be benchmarked against? Would it be other sources of gas, and which gas?
Yeah.
Would it be indexed to coal or renewables?
Yeah.
So that's the first question. But if we look back at sort of the last price reform in 2014, 2015, the government was raising domestic prices to meet import costs, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, oil prices crashed. And so competitive fuels became much cheaper. And gas demand growth in China went from 12-13% to 3% in that 1 year because of that policy misstep.
Right.
Now it was corrected, right? And we've seen in
the last couple of years the
policy move that's led to this stellar growth. But if they misjudge the market or if they misjudge which competitive fuels they need to link gas to, we could get a much slower demand growth scenario. And the other argument that people in China often make is that there's no such thing as cheap gas in China. So again, is it going to be competitive with coal unless you really push it to be competitive?
And of course, the price setting, is that going to be done by supply demand, or is it going to be done by regulated price tariffs?
It's likely to be done by regulated price tariffs and linked to market movements, but it's still, I mean, if we look at oil prices, which are sort of a bit further along the liberalized sort of the reform path, they're linked to international prices, but they're still adjusted every 10 days by the government.
Yeah, exactly. So therefore, it is that central regulation. But there's some supply-demand element around it, because I imagine they're reflecting that in the regulated prices.
Well, they're reflecting global supply-demand and what it thinks of market movements. Yes, but gas prices haven't really, the government set Citygate benchmarks haven't changed in a year.
Okay, so that answers the question. I think I'd like to come in this podcast to talk about coal and maybe the environment a little bit more later. But before we get to that, I'd like to talk maybe at the other end of the carbon scale, which is, you know, what about electric vehicles? You know, could their penetration lead to greater power demand and therefore indirectly, I think I'm really saying, gas demand growth?
again, that sort of assumes that gas will be a significant part of the power stack, which it is unlikely to be. And then that goes back to the issue of electrification. That, yes, China's already the biggest EV market globally, but it still relies quite heavily on coal, potentially renewables if we get to distributed energy, and sort of to new models that we're already seeing, quite innovative models, in the way sort of the battery swapping and things like that. But it all comes back down to the power sector, which is heavily reliant on coal still.
As we've discussed. Well, before we move to the environment, I'd just like to dip into oil for a minute, if I may. You know, what is the outlook for China's oil demand? Because, you know, China has been a key contributor to global oil demand growth, and I'm just wondering whether the environmental policies will actually change that level of demand growth.
They probably will. I mean, environmental policies and the EV penetration and, I guess, changing mobility structures or sort of forms of mobility have really dented gasoline demand growth. It's halved from sort of over 10% per annum to 5% in the last couple of years. But at least in the CNPC forecast, and we can't forget that they're an oil and gas company, their bread and butter is oil, they expect gasoline demand to peak in 2025, which is relatively soon. But they see demand for aviation, so for jet fuel and for petrochemicals, which again ties back into this consumer story, rising throughout sort of 2040, 2050. But sort of black oil, I guess, the main four, that's where demand growth starts to slow. But it's interesting also for Asian markets, the Chinese refiners. The big issue has been, or sort of the kind of mandate was, build local refining capacity. Import oil, but produce everything domestically, right? There's localization. And as they keep building refineries and adding more capacity, they will need to export a lot of the surplus capacity now. Unless they switch to petrochemicals, which they are, they're still going to have a big surplus of oil products, which will start impacting Asian refiners and hurting their margins.
And even though, of course, this is a natural gas podcast, I think it's important that we actually have that discussion on to discuss oil as well. Can we just go to the environmental policy? I'd like to talk specifically about that. You know, can you tell us about their progressive environmental scenario, Beautiful China?
Yes, so the Beautiful China, again, that's where you get the kind of government mandate. That, and there is real thinking about how to make China's demand growth more sustainable. Now, the challenge always with these forecasts is that there's no breakdown of the underlying methodology, but one of the scenarios that they do explore is renewables penetrating the energy mix much faster. But even that sort of fast transition happens after 2030, and then it's coal that loses share of both the power stack and the energy mix, but gas loses ground in that as well. The share of gas in the energy mix remains at around 15%. It goes from
It's their target.
That's roughly their target, and sort of wherever you look at it, it doesn't grow much beyond that. But in a Beautiful China scenario, and in a more, again, environmentally progressive scenario, gas loses out to renewables as well, but obviously coal takes the biggest hit.
But is it realistic, do you think, the scenario they're painting, the Beautiful China scenario? Is it a realistic scenario?
I mean, the environmentalists, kind of the environmental lobbies, if you think about sort of the renewables people in China, are definitely advocating these as kind of their base cases. These environmental scenarios are certainly not far-fetched if there were to be considerable support for renewables, and mainly, I mean, they've introduced lots of incentives to develop the renewable capacity. The issue they face now is getting it onto the grid. And it's overcoming sort of grid resistance.
So it's an infrastructure issue.
It's an infrastructure, it's a political and policy issue. The hardware is there, but you need the price reform, you need the incentive structures to make sure that actually the grid doesn't go straight to the coal producers who are their best friends and with whom they've been.
What did you say, coal? Because something else you say in your paper is coal is by no means unanimously viewed as the climate villain in China. I found that very surprising, but that is because the coal producers are part of the major infrastructure and the major energy supply in the country?
They're major infrastructure, they're a major employer as well.
Yeah, of course.
The coal industry.
Never forget that, must we?
It employs, roughly the size of Norway in China, the sort of population of Norway. And it's a big source of tax revenues for the government. But also, coal is available, it's relatively cheap, barring the mining accidents, and it's reliable. In the context of the US-China trade war, security of supply is a big issue. And again, it's all about air quality, not so much about carbon emissions. Absolutely. Now, I think that will might evolve over time. But for now, as China thinks about growing, developing, feeding mouths, and helping them have a more comfortable life, coal is readily available, and why should they forego it?
Well, why don't we turn to your second paper as we get to kind of the end of our podcast and talk about the paper's China Energy Security 70 that you published to coincide, I think it was with the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, which is October 1st, of course, 2019. Can you perhaps share with us the messages from that second paper?
I mean, what we sort of tried to highlight was that you know, supply security has been mainly an oil issue for China. Increasingly now it's for gas, but it relies on sort of 70% of its total oil is imported. And it's typically been an issue of Middle East, right? Middle Eastern security and geopolitics. But what the past month has highlighted, sort of September, October have highlighted with the attacks on Saudi infrastructure in the Middle East, but then US sanctions on Chinese shipping entities, is that the US is a greater threat to Chinese energy security than sort of Middle East instability, which is slightly worrisome. Now, of course, you can, you know, what the US does in the Middle East impacts China as well. But the, you know, the attacks on the Saudi facilities, they led to a certain degree of concern, but then Aramco pretty much reassured its Chinese consumers that they would get oil, even if Aramco had to starve its own refineries for it. And the Chinese still got their oil supply. So, I mean, there's something to be said about being the largest client of all these Middle Eastern producers. And yet, when the US decides to place sanctions on the biggest Chinese shipper, and the market stops using it, just because it doesn't know which of its subsidiaries has been sanctioned and whatnot, then you have a bigger issue here. And so the US, and sort of if you kind of unravel that a little bit, this whole notion of, I think the US-China trade war is not just about trade, right? It's about geopolitical dominance, it's about technology, and if China is now thinking that the US is out to contain its rise, then it has to think about its supply security and about hedging, perhaps nationalizing its supply chains, its shippers, its insurance companies, maybe even de-dollarizing some of its commodity trade, and just making sure that it is insulated as much as it can against US sanctions, because actually it's demonstrated to itself that it, in terms of oil supply security, it's hedged pretty well.
Exactly. And also, of course, the supply route security, the pinch points, Malacca Strait and Straits of Hormuz and other places. Well, look, now, we've covered a lot of subjects over the last 25 minutes, but I always like to end up these podcasts by asking really perhaps the most difficult question. I apologise that. But, you know, how's it all going to end up? You know, what will China energy demand look like in 10 years, and what's going to happen with respect to gas supply and pricing in the country? It's your the last word. Come on, Mikhail.
So I think obviously we have to assume ongoing economic growth, albeit at a slower pace. We're not assuming any kind of China crash, collapse, implosion scenario. It keeps growing. And therefore, we are going to see this shift from industrial demand to consumer demand. And gas is going to play a part in that transition, but I doubt that it's going to be the sort of biggest market. Again, we're likely to see this doubling of the gas market in China, which means plenty of opportunities for the LNG market. But with this renewed emphasis on supply security and energy security, because I don't think tensions with the US go away, even if we get some kind of a trade deal, the underlying structural tensions are there to remain. And so the Chinese will want to develop domestic production, they'll want to develop pipelines, maybe even shale to the extent that they can, and limit their exposure to global LNG markets. Price reform will be a much thornier issue, and again, in the short term, that could lead to actually negative surprises rather than positive surprises. But I think over time, the Chinese market will liberalize and open up, and perhaps even in ways that we don't necessarily expect, with the Chinese becoming more active price makers, trying to switch more trading to RMB. We might see pockets of oversupply within China, because we've got lots of different competing actors, and some re-exports of Chinese gas. Now, obviously, China will remain a net importer of gas, but some...
But they're already doing that. They're already diverting kind of What I find fascinating about this is, for the listeners of our podcast, is they can look at the lines of the demand coming out of China, but actually understanding the geopolitical aspects and how that links is really important to understand what the realistic demand. Now, of course, you've just joined the Institute, haven't you, as the director of the China Energy Programme. So imagine these are the things that you're going to be looking at, are you? Is that what your plan is over the next coming years?
Definitely. I mean, the China Energy Programme will be looking at sort of the geopolitics of energy and how they impact markets, policies and regulations, and how they change both the energy mix in the longer term, but also the short-term market dynamics, because the policy movements in China have really shifted the balance within months. Yeah. So the China Energy Programme is going to look sort of across commodities at policies, politics, at the markets, at the mix, at the macro.
And you're going to be offering papers for the public, but also I think you're doing private podcasts, aren't you, just for the sponsors?
Yes.
And so we'll be doing that, so we can offer a greater knowledge on it. Well, that's, Mikhail, fantastic. You know, I really, you know, enjoyed our time. It's our first podcast together, and I hope we do more. And, you know, your two papers, Glimpses of China's Energy Future and the China Energy Security 70, can be found at our website, www.oxenergy.org, where, of course, you can find all our more podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. As always, I hope you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everybody.